content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. It seems that now more than ever, people are finding it harder and harder to agree. Not to worry. Dorothy Rossby helps us remember that sometimes we just have to agree to disagree. Our first few stories today are from her book, Alexa's a Spy and Other Things to be Ticked Off About, Humorous Essays on the Hassles of Our Time, copyright 2020. The first essay, What is the Matter with Everyone? I like my drinks ice cold or scalding hot, nothing in between, except tomato juice, which I like at room temperature. I like tea, but I don't care for coffee. And I like iced tea better than hot tea, except when I'm chilly. I'm often chilly, even in the summer, because some people turn their air conditioners higher than I think should be legal. No, I'm not nuts, though I do like nuts, any kind. But I like pistachios and almonds best, and cashews least. That's lucky, because cashews are both my husband's and my son's favorite. My family gets along fine with a can of mixed nuts, which some would say is a fitting metaphor. I'm not telling you all this because I aspire to be one of those celebrities making demands for my dressing room. But since you asked, I'd like red roses, a radio tuned to NPR, and Diet Cola. I want the cola over crushed, not cubed, ice, and I'd prefer it from a fountain, not a plastic bottle. Either Pepsi or Coke is fine, though. I'm not picky. And neither one has agreed to endorse me. No, the reason I'm telling you all this is because I'm intrigued by preferences. If I could get a research grant to study something, I would study why other people like what they like and not what I like. Is everyone except me deeply flawed? It's fascinating. I doubt I could get a research grant, though, because I can't imagine a foundation thinking this is as important as I do. Plus, I'm not a researcher. What I am is particular and curious. For example, I'm particular about not putting salt on my watermelon and curious about why some people do. On the other hand, some people like salt on their tomatoes, me. And some people think that's a waste of tomatoes and salt. They might even sprinkle sugar on their tomatoes, which I consider completely irrational. Is it nature? Are their taste buds simply inferior to mine? Or is it nurture? Did their mothers think a spoonful of sugar would make the vegetables go down? Yes, I know, tomatoes are fruits, but I prefer to think of them as vegetables. In keeping with my ice-cold and scalding-hot preference, I believe it's never too hot for soup and never too cold for ice cream. But I have a relative who turns his nose up at soup, behavior I consider un-American. And given the choice, he would choose any other dessert over ice cream. If he can't be trusted to choose Rocky Road over angel food, how can he be trusted at all? I used to lunch with a friend who always carefully removed all the onions, peppers, and tomatoes from her salad and then gave them to me. I'd watch her doing this and think, "What is wrong with you?" But I kept my opinion to myself, because that's the kind of person I am. Plus, I was happy to get her onions, peppers, and tomatoes. I know someone who doesn't like her food to touch, Her potatoes must never touch her meatloaf, and neither one must ever touch her green beans. Meanwhile, I purposely take a little of each on my fork so I can chew them all together. It's quicker, so I have a better chance of getting seconds. Plus, it tastes better. Why can't she do it my way? It isn't just food, of course. Some people are shoe store people. Some people are furniture store people. I'm an office supply store gal myself. I go there often for the printer cartridges, but I stay for the pens, markers, and highlighters. And I love planners, like a hardware store person loves light fixtures. And so it goes. Some people are car people, and some people are truck people. Some people are dog people, and some people are cat people. Some people are morning people, some people are night people, and some people aren't people at all, except for an hour or two around dinner time. But every one of them has at least one thing in common. They didn't consult me when they were deciding what kind of people to be. What is the matter with everyone? In our next story, the essay, The Coolest Generation. The first people to ever make disparaging remarks about the younger generation were Adam and Eve, and for good reason. Cain and Abel never could get along. But every generation since has found fault with the next one. I hate to break it to you, but complaining about kids nowadays is the first sign of aging. Besides, as somebody smarter than me once put it, those who criticize the younger generation forget who raised it. The second sign of aging is romanticizing the good old days. Adam and Eve did that too, and who can blame them? Remember back in the garden, Eve? Yeah, I loved that place, except for the snakes. I didn't care for the apples either. The rest of us don't have anything quite like the Garden of Eden to reminisce about, but we still get nostalgic. I've seen a handful of social media posts lately that show both of these symptoms of aging, and they didn't come from Adam and Eve. I feel compelled to address this issue because, to my way of thinking, a handful is an epidemic. The posts rant about how past generations were not only smarter, but tougher, which is, of course, true. I'm joking. Whether it's true or not, the way the creators of these diatribes choose to make their point is not helping their cause. One of the emails implies that because we weren't afraid to eat raw hamburger and we rode our bikes without wearing helmets, among other things, we must be tougher. When I was a child, I personally engaged in both behaviors, now considered risky. But the main reason I didn't wear a bike helmet is because you could hardly find them. And hamburger is produced and processed somewhat differently these days. Would sampling it raw now make me tougher or dumber? Don't answer that. The writer of one of the other emails implies that we were somehow better children because we didn't play computer games and we swam in lakes instead of swimming pools. But today's children are only using the inventions created and perfected by generations before them. You can't blame them for that. If I'd had a computer when I was a child, I probably would have played computer games too, if I could have figured out how. And yes, I swam in a lake, but that's because I didn't have access to a pool. If I had, I'm sure I'd have swum in it, especially that summer we found the dead cow in the lake. The author of one of the posts I read recently implies that his childhood was superior in part because when he was young, nurses wore hats, he wore high-top Keds, and cell phones hadn't been invented yet. I'm not sure I ever owned a pair of high tops. I don't care whether nurses wear hats or not. But that summer day when I was 17 and stranded on a lonely highway with car troubles, I really could have used a cell phone or a nurse with a car. Waxing nostalgic about the good old days may simply be a symptom of age-related memory loss. Nostalgia is, after all, the overwhelming sense that everything was better if it happened so long ago we can't remember it. How good could the good old days have been if we were eating raw hamburger and smacking our heads on the pavement every time we wrecked our bikes? It's helpful to remember that back while we were living in whatever era we think of as the good old days, someone else was calling a previous era the good old days. Even more remarkable, someday our children will call these days the good old days. Then they'll start criticizing the next generation, and that's when we'll know they're old. They're already criticizing us. If Adam and Eve were the first to criticize the next generation for their music, fashion, work ethic, and inexperience, Cain and Abel were the first to criticize the last one for being hopelessly out of touch, as though they alone were cool and would be the first and only generation to remain that way forever. And so it goes, generation after generation, like some hereditary disease, young people forgetting they stand on the shoulders of the geezers who came before them, and older people forgetting the whippersnappers will soon be running things, possibly better than they did, but certainly no worse. That's why I wasn't surprised to find the following article in my internet news feed recently. 25 Tragically Uncool Things Baby Boomers Won't Let Die. But I was surprised to find there were actually 65 items on the list, which suggests that proofreading might be one of the things the authors find tragically uncool. They didn't mention their names, maybe fearing their grandmothers would stop sending them birthday money. Nor did they say what generation they belong to, X, Y, or Z. I'm sure in their minds that goes without saying. It's the cool one. To call wallpaper, throw pillows, and Mrs. Dash tragically uncool seems a bit overdramatic. And the authors are prone to sweeping generalizations, too. As I read their list of things that baby boomers think are cool but they so aren't, I realized that I, an actual baby boomer, didn't find most of them cool at all, or tragically uncool for that matter. I'm a live-and-let-live kind of person myself, which I think is one of my cooler qualities. And while I don't own them myself, if someone wants to wear an airbrushed T-shirt, denim shorts, and Crocs, I'm blissfully neutral about it, as I am about golf, scripted wall art, and Yahoo. I don't even own a tragically uncool landline anymore, though I wish I did every time I misplace my cell phone somewhere in my house, which is fairly often. I don't play racquetball either, but I think anyone who puts their smartphone down long enough to exercise is pretty cool. I also don't type messages in all capital letters, another allegedly uncool sin of baby boomers. You'll notice I haven't used all caps once in this entire piece. So there! I do occasionally shop in malls, which are, according to the authors, tragically uncool since they buy whatever they want online. I have two words for them. Orange Julius. Besides, malls are staffed with people, some of them very cool, who need jobs. I've been known to iron, but not because I think it's cool. I do it when my clothes look like I slept in them, which is not cool at all. I'll be happy to let email die and learn the next cool thing. But cool or not, people keep emailing me, so I keep emailing them back, because not responding when someone is trying to reach me is rude. And rude isn't cool in any generation. I have neither the time nor the energy to discuss them all, but I will say that of all 65 items on the list of 25 tragically uncool things baby boomers supposedly love, there were only a few I'd go so far as to call cool. My husband and I celebrated our 30th anniversary with a cruise, and I say, don't knock it till you've tried it. Anyone who thinks meatloaf is uncool never ate my mom's, though it's possible they ate mine. And I enjoy an episode of NCIS now and then. It gives me something to watch while I iron. Somewhere between tragically uncool juice from concentrate and paying bills the old-fashioned way, the authors managed to blame baby boomers for the Social Security predicament, though we don't find that any cooler than they do. I'd advise them to start saving for retirement, because whether they believe it or not, they'll be older and uncool someday too. But the cool part about getting older is you no longer worry so much about being cool. And that's a good thing, because there's an entire generation coming up behind you, ready to tell just how uncool you are, exactly like you once did to someone else. Today's last story from Dorothy Rosby, Leave Recyclables to Grandchildren. I admit it. I reuse plastic cutlery. Don't worry, I wash it first. And it's not like I'm reusing paper plates. Disposable just seems like a funny way to describe something that will outlast us, our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and probably their stainless steel knives, forks, and spoons, too. Heck, we could pass down plastic cutlery as family heirlooms. See this fork, honey? Your great-grandmother ate cake with it at her 4th birthday party. Besides, spending money on something so durable and using it only once feels wasteful to someone who grew up wearing darned socks. I know some people prefer we not reuse plastic cutlery, the makers of plastic cutlery, for example. And some people find it distasteful to eat with a plastic spoon someone else ate with first, so I don't tell them. Still others say if you're going to reuse plastic cutlery, why not just use the real thing in the first place? My thoughts exactly. It turns out there's a whole month set aside for people like us. Welcome to Plastic Free July. Plastic Free July began in Australia in 2011 to raise awareness about the problems of single-use disposable plastic and to challenge us to do something about it. I was trying to do something about it long before I heard about Plastic Free July. For years, I've carried a giant reusable mug with me wherever I go. I drink water out of it. I drink iced tea and Diet Cola out of it. The only beverages I don't drink out of it are milk, juice, and whiskey, because then I'd have to wash it more often. Plus, I don't care for whiskey. I've even been known to rummage through other people's trash, take out their plastic bottles, and put them in the recycling bin. They don't appreciate it as much as you'd think they would. Millions of people from around the world now participate in Plastic Free July by pledging to avoid buying single-use plastic items for the month. If I can convince everyone I know to join us, I won't have to dig through anyone's trash for 31 whole days. I would love that. They probably would, too. Obviously, Plastic-Free July is just the beginning. We won't make much headway if, come August, we stock up on bottled water and plastic forks. And single-use plastic is hard to avoid. My detergent, shampoo, and dishwashing soap all come in plastic bottles. I dream of a day when stores are filled with giant barrels of shampoo and lotion. You'll walk in with your empty bottle and say, "Fill her up." But for now, people like me will keep washing plastic spoons and digging through everyone else's trash looking for plastic bottles. And we'll find them. Americans throw away 50 million plastic beverage bottles every day. Honestly, I don't know how we get anything else done. And I'm not convinced some bottled water isn't just a scam anyway. There are hundreds of brands of bottled water with pretty names like Something Springs, Fresh This, and Aqua That. I wonder if some of them should be called Pure Baloney. I picture employees filling bottles from a faucet, then sticking on pretty labels with pictures of waterfalls on them. Just to be clear, I don't take plastic forks out of anyone's trash, or styrofoam cups and straws. I may be concerned, but I'm not crazy. Also, those aren't recyclable. I wish they were. Americans toss 25 billion styrofoam cups every year, which is a whole lot of chocolate and coffee. The number of straws we discard is not as clear, though maybe we could make an educated guess if we all started digging them out of other people's trash. And don't get me started on plastic bags. Oh, too late. Up to a trillion plastic bags are used worldwide each year, but less than 1% are recycled. And do you know where the other 99% go? Into my yard. That's where. I'm exaggerating, but I'm a little touchy about the subject right now because there's been a plastic bag tangled in the cottonwood tree outside my dining room window for more than 6 months. Based on my research on plastic, there's a good chance it will outlast the tree. And plastic isn't the only issue. Think about that aluminum can the next time you have a pop, or a soda pop, depending on where you are when you're drinking it. I hope you like it, because, according to my good friend, Google, that aluminum can will still be around for the next 200 to 400 years unless you recycle it. Your food cans will last around 50 years, though I don't think you should wait that long to eat your tuna and green beans. It's sobering to think that our great-grandchildren won't even know who we are, but they could still be kicking our cans and bottles down the driveway. That's why I've decided to leave my descendants aluminum cans and plastic forks instead of money. They'll last longer, and I have more of them. Our last bit of advice today is from Irma Bombeck. From her book, Forever Irma, Best Loved Writing from America's Favorite Humorist, copyright 1996. The column, Speak Thermostat, dated December 19, 1982. My husband has been trying to teach our children to speak thermostat for years. They say the younger you start to teach them a foreign language, the faster they learn. This has not been the case. Flush did not come easy for them. Neither did lights. thermostat, is one of the last of the foreign languages to be taught to children. It comes just after hang up that phone and shut the door. Note to parents, please do not proceed to thermostat until they are speaking shut the door fluently. There are several methods of teaching thermostat. Some parents use the Berlitz concept. They put recordings beneath the pillows of children that instruct, a thermostat controls the furnace. When the door is open, the bad cold air wants to come in, and the furnace tries very hard to heat the outdoors. God never meant for a furnace to heat America, or he would never have invented snow. One of the first phrases a child learns about thermostat is, my room is cold. My room is cold voluntarily triggers his motor activity. He will proceed to the thermostat and with nimble precision move the thermostat dial to 82 degrees. By sheer coincidence, the boiling point of his father. This is followed by, my room is hot. However, a strange phenomenon occurs. Instead of turning the thermostat back, your child will open a window. He needs work in the language. Our children were slow. We spent a year and a half on how do you spell relief? SWEATER. We spent another 2 years on Daddy is not a rich man, and we can no longer afford 3 children. It wasn't until last week, when we took them on a field trip to the meter, that they seemed to comprehend what we were talking about. We showed them how the little dials twirled around on the meter, and how we were charged for each little twirl. They watched our lips closely as we formed the word bankruptcy. One of them said, wait a minute, are you telling us that the colder it gets outside, the harder the furnace has to work to keep it warm inside? We nodded happily. And every time it clicks on, it costs money? We jumped up and down excitedly. Why didn't you say so? My husband smiled. Do you think we can progress to thank you? I hate to push them before they're ready, I said. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.